Hello and welcome to Focus on Business. I'm your host, Lee Strickland. On today's show, we are talking with Mike and David McGrail of the McGrail Group. Mike's corporate experience includes sales and marketing, management roles in the divisions of IBM, Exxon, and M&M Mars before he founded the McGrail Group in 1990. Mike is a results-oriented leader and trainer and coach. His consulting programs include strategic management, sales development, and personal productivity. His consulting and clients have ranged from executives in Fortune 500 organizations to the small entrepreneurial company. In the talent development and search areas, he has assessed thousands of individuals for job fit in sales and management. And David has been a member of the McGrail Group for 5 years. I'm told he's heading to Johnson & Johnson soon. So we're happy to have them both on the show today. David's background is at St. Joseph's University studying business administration and finance. We have similar backgrounds. And in 2008, he maintained an active leadership role in managed sales and marketing for the McGrail Group. So, guys, welcome to the show today. And let's get started by understanding what it is you do in developing sales teams and productivity and just making organizations better.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Leo. Our business is focused very clearly on assessing, consulting, and training. It's a simple process of looking first at the person and the organization, assessing them, making sure that we know what they need and we understand their needs. And then we consult around the issues that we find in that assessing process. And that leads to inevitably either working with them to develop their people or to develop the organization the way they want it to be developed.
So an organization brings you in to look at a member of their team or their team as a whole individually,
yes.
Assess that, how it fits with the roles they're in and where they're going to go and what the organization needs, and then you start looking for the gaps and the issues.
Usually there's always something that drives them to we need some help here.
The pain, the problem.
the pain and the problem. Very clearly, I was, tell you a story, at a church event at one time, and it was nothing to do with anything business or at all, and one of the men there said to me, "Mike, what do you do?" And I said, "Oh, I have a leadership and sales development company." He started searching through his pockets, and he was going through everything saying, "I need to see you Monday." Well, that was the beginning of a 7-year-long relationship that formed from that event.
Right.
He needed some real serious help. And that process of doing that started with just one individual. One senior executive on the team needed to be looked at in terms of where this person eventually will end up. And he was very, very concerned. He was a friend of his, all
right.
Those kinds of things. So the reality is that that was one instance of one person looking for ways to develop people, and they were looking for somebody they could trust to do it.
Right.
And that clearly was evidenced in what we were doing at the church and that sort of thing. And he said, "Here's a guy I can trust. I want to talk to you."
Right.
So.
Well, in organizations, we frequently think about the bad corporations or the bad businesses and the evils of profit and those kind of things that's portrayed in the media. But each organization is owned by, managed by, led by, serviced by people that we'd like to think are doing the best they can in the framework of their skills, their experiences, and their perspectives.
Exactly.
And so maximizing those, equipping everyone to understand that when you're in the workplace, when you're dealing with your co-employees, your bosses, your subordinates, the customer, we're selling. Mm-hmm. We're selling ourselves. We're selling our message. We're selling our products and our services. And once we get that mentality and that right framework, that sets us up for success, doesn't
right.
it?
It always comes from the vision. That one person that I talked to had a vision literally 5 years, 10 years down the road. And he was in an organization where he was brought in to totally change it.
Right.
Now, he didn't say that to me, didn't say it to his team initially. But the reality is that they had a very, very, very big vision of where they were going and what they were going to do. And it was a local organization that had been local and doing things locally for a number of years, had been successful in what they did, but they saw the worldview.
Right.
They came to it, and this person came to it with a total worldview. And over those 7 years, we basically opened up plants in China,
right,
in England, in Spain, literally across the country. And all of those places needed people development. And that's part of the assessment process and all that.
And in that, we frequently want to hold our bastions of the way we've always done it, or the way we've always managed people, or the way we think. And we have generational issues. We have the millennials to the baby boomers in the workplace. We have those in our marketplace that we're selling to and we're trying to message to. We have all these more complex dynamics, and we start seeing more opportunities.
Right.
But to more opportunities always mean change.
Yes.
Transition, transformation, and growth.
And what this particular person saw as well is that he had some great people skilled in what they do, really, really skilled in what they do. But he knew that what they needed was that new vision. He knew they needed to change. He knew they needed to grow. And he knew he needed help to do all of that. And that was the process of the 7 years that we spent with him in various aspects of development.
So you come in, and what does an assessment look like? Where does that start? Because a lot of people think, okay, I'm going to go to the dentist and get assessed, right? It's not a pleasant thought of getting an assessment, because criticism, we're used to being torn down rather than looking at our strengths and those kind of things. So
right.
What's an assessment like?
An assessment is a process that starts with a bunch of questions. You know, what are you trying to do?
Where there are no wrong answers.
Where there are no wrong answers, where it's all a question of what are your goals, what are your principles, what are you trying to build here? And once you get a better understanding of that, then you can sit down and say, okay, let's go through a battery of real assessments using tools that measure personality, mental abilities, and validity scales, and all of the stuff that goes into that, as well as all the communications environments. We know that communication is critical. We know that we all have different communication styles, but what we don't know is how they apply to the other person. We only know our own, generally speaking. And all of the assessments that we've done over the years, I say to most people that what we do is take 2 years out of the process of getting to know the person that works
right.
for you. And what we can absolutely assure most people is that we don't reveal any, in quote, secrets or any
right.
of those kinds of things. What we show is what it is that they have that are strengths, and what are developmental areas that we could work with to help them grow to be all they can be. So the process is fairly simple, but yet fairly complex, because the variables
yes.
are many. And what we focus on is culture fit. How does that person fit into the organization? Which means, for us, we assess the top echelon first.
Right.
Say, what does this look like? Okay. Now, if people are going to get along and be able to develop with that organization and that culture, what does it take to fit into that? And that is a part of it. And it's not a perfect fit, never is. None of the assessments that we ever do are, in quotes, perfect models of the perfect person, because there is no such thing.
There was only one, and he got crucified.
That's correct. That is absolutely correct. And as long as we keep that in mind,
right.
and as long as we recognize what we're doing is developing the person and developing the organization, we call it getting on track for a victory lap. And it's all about a process of looking at the vision, looking at what needs to change, and then getting the team and the organization behind you doing those kinds of things to change.
How difficult is it? Because I can go back to one of my experiences when I was recruited, and the organization sent you to an off-site location before you joined the company or even got the offer. You spent 8 hours getting assessed that day, everything from your math skills to spatial relationships to others. They get the results, and then they're kind of surprised who they hired. And it's like, okay, you spent all that time getting this, like, the ethics and things, and I peg the ethics. I think everything's black and white. Unfortunately, the organization I joined was more living in the shades of gray or in the black zone. and the shock whenever I wouldn't go along with it. So that I see those organizations, you get the assessments and they really don't know what they mean. And they get surprised when it's that the person turns out to be exactly what they hired.
Right. We do what we call a know yourself, a workshop with people to be sure that everybody understands all the dynamics. There are many dynamics in the process. And one thing that we do make sure of is that people understand that it's a positive program. It's a positive development program. It's not about how I get you nailed by virtue of how bad you are in this or that or whatever. It's all of us need development of some sort or another. We all need to get better at what we do some way or another. And what we do is identify those areas of strength.
Mm-hmm.
What are you really good at? How do we really build on those strengths to build the organization and build you? And how do we look at the developmental issues and say, how does it play in as a team? How does it play in as an organization? And how do you have to be accountable personally to make some of those changes?
Now, one of the international executives I worked with at one of the big corporations I was at, we were having a conversation, and he said, well, in most countries outside the United States, we focus on what we do right. The United States spends 90% of their time saying, well, this is all the stuff we do wrong, or these are our weaknesses, mm-hmm. and let's spend our time there. The book Strength Finders mm-hmm. kind of turns that on its end, and it sounds like that's right. some of what you're talking about. Build your strengths. Play to your strengths. You're wired this way.
That's correct.
Build a team that is comprised of different individuals with different strengths, and don't put as much resources on fixing the non-diplomat or whatever, but put them in the right position
sure.
to build on those strengths and those and maximize that.
There are three specific instruments that we use pretty routinely now, one of which is about the mental fit. How do you learn? How do you grow? How do you fit in mentally into the organization, and how do you adapt that? How do you do what you have to do to be growing in that? Then there's the personality side of it. That's the stuff that is basically not going to change. It's who you are. But the question there becomes, what do you do when you know who you are? If you know, for instance, that you are the kind of person that really likes to work alone. I mean, just really likes to work alone. Worked with a CEO one time of a company that when we assessed him and it showed how introverted he was, how much he really enjoyed yeah. working alone, I looked him right in the eye and I says, how do you do it? And he said, do what? And I said, how do you get through the day looking at 1,200 people in your organization, interacting with those 1,200 people? You must be exhausted at the end of the day. And he looked at me like I had just shot him right between the eyes. And he said, how did you know that? And I said, because your profile says that. Your profile says that
you spend so much energy.
Right. You have to overcome this desire to work alone and to work on numbers and work the finance side of it and that sort of thing. You'd rather be in the office building your models and your charts and your processes and working with those than the people that work for you. So you have to interact. You're here in a plant. You've got all these people. You know that you've got all this interaction. So at the end of the day, you're going to be de-energized by that process. Somebody that is extroverted is going to be energized by that. So what you need to look at how you do this and how you do it daily so that you aren't de-energized all the time.
Yeah, he needed to unplug and just yes. kind of retreat periodically right. to do it.
He had to be comfortable with closing his doors for an hour at a time and saying, you know, this is me and I'm going to work on this. But when I go into the field and work with the teams,
you turn it on.
You turn it on. And that's a balancing issue, and that's a part of the process of saying how to work to strengths. His strength was he knew the numbers. He knew the models. He knew the processes. He knew the right way to do things. But getting people to interact and to especially work through the difficult things, the kinds of struggles that come from enlightened self-interest by department.
Right.
Sales department wants one thing, the lower prices, and, you know, the manufacturing wants more production. Everybody's got something that they want to see happen. How do you make all that work together? How do you get them to play together? And that's a part of that.
Well, and it's, again, it's when you sit down and we took an assessment, some of the teams we were putting together, and I thought, well, let's see who we actually have here. You kind of get instinctively over the years. Mm-hmm. You know who wants to be the introvert and just wants to turn things in the background and who's going to be on stage and who's the relationship builder, and you do that. But it's funny to sit down and people say, well, I want to be the relationship builder. And it's like, well, that's not the way you're wired.
Right.
And wanting to be something other than you are is the exhausting process.
Yes.
Sometimes in your role, you have to do that. I mean, Myers-Briggs, I'm a perceiver. I love piles of paper, but in my office, everything is color-coded, everything is labeled, and and there's 20 in baskets for each type of category. So everything is segregated. My calendar is color-coded because I really don't want to deal with it.
Right.
And so that's the easiest way to do it. But that, to me, that's a coping thing.
Right.
I know my personality. I know what it takes to deal with it. And I don't think organizations or even individuals in those organizations are as adaptable to letting people do things within parameters, but do it their way.
That's the challenge that everybody has, is that I mentioned that there are three specific things that we look to in terms of the assessments. One is how does the person actually fit? But then what kind of personality style do they have? And if you start looking at styles and you say, you know, I'm a high D and I'm somebody that is a real driver and real expressive and all that sort of stuff, if I'm an I, the reality is that each of us have personal preferences. What's important is to understand how they impact the other person. So we try to spend a lot of time, mostly with sales organizations, for instance, and with teams, to kind of make sure that people understand the other person.
Right.
If they're selling, they need to know the buyer. They need to understand how that buyer buys. If they're looking for all of the information and they need 20 pages of it, you can tell that pretty much by
Is it a detailed person that wants the minute detail and then they're going to make the big decision, or is it the guy that wants the 30,000 view and let somebody else deal with the detail later?
Tell me net, what have I got here, okay, and what will it cost? And that's the end of the story. If you tell them what it costs and you ask for the order, you're out of there. But somebody that's very analytical, they're going to ask for a lot of detail and ask you to come back two or three times. That's a part of selling. That's a part of understanding who you're dealing with. The third thing that we look at in terms of all of these things are the strengths. The Strengths Finder is a very, very good instrument to help people to truly understand when you look at the myriad of possibilities that they could be doing, and that hardly one in a million is the exact same.
Right.
You look at that and you say, okay, well, what do I have to be doing to build on that strength rather than let it be a part of a problem? And oftentimes people look at the strengths and say, oh, that's a weakness. And all strengths have the opposite going for them. So,
well, it's how you deploy the tool.
Right.
Because I have clients, oddly enough, one of them is a leadership training organization.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And can never execute on the projects we're working with. And she always falls back on, but on my Myers-Briggs type, I'm an ENFP. And I said, well, congratulations, so am I. No excuse. You can execute. You just have to adapt on how you're going to do it.
Right.
So using our strengths or our weaknesses is an excuse not to learn, not to grow, not to adapt, not to interact is also a stumbling block.
And one of the things I've talked with Dave over the years as well in terms of working together and doing some of the things we've done together is kind of look at that whole thing in terms of how people actually interact with each other and how they need to be able to adapt and what that means. And the reality of that is that, in effect, you have to be constantly looking, how do I add value, right? And Dave has been challenged over the last number of years to look at various situations, very different sort of situations, and look at them and say, okay, how do I make a difference as a manager? How do I make a difference as a person? And what do I do with some of those things? And wanted Dave to kind of talk a little bit about some of the examples of adding value and literally doing that, kind of being the person that says, oh, I realized that I had to be a good manager, and that required me to study a little bit more perhaps than I needed to when I joined the organization. But now I see myself in the role of being a motivator.
Right.
And that those challenges.
Well, I'm gonna peg Dave with a question that it's more of a millennial question.
Yep.
I was teaching a management class. It was a 1-day, 4-hour thing at one of the local colleges. And went in, 50 people in the room, it's 4 hours, they're there for that. Walked in, and more than 80% of the room said they were going to manage. They were going to be managers. But no one knew what they were going to manage. So kind of talk to that from, one, from the generational perspective of where you're coming from. Because I know when I walked out of college, I knew I was going to manage people, whether they were salespeople or finance people, or I knew that. So kind of give us some of those examples that Mike was talking about, and then kind of address that from the millennial perspective, if you can, too.
I'd be glad to. Thanks for having me on. So, yeah, I'm a millennial, as she pegged me for, and I grew up...
I'm a boomer.
I grew up in this industry that my... This is my dad's company, and I've known from the time I was 9 years old that I was an INFP, I think. I learned
so
that.
So you're an introverted, you're intuitive feeling, and you like piles of paper.
Yes.
You're right there. Okay.
And I've known that since was nine, but I didn't know what any of that meant. So I come at it from, I guess, the millennial perspective of everything's kind of individualistic. Experiences are more important than necessarily piles of money. Although piles of money are great and they help.
You don't turn them down.
They buy the experiences too. So you definitely can't turn them down. But I've also come from a kind of an industry agnostic perspective. I think that previous generations viewed things like, okay, I'm going to go into this one industry and I'm going to work at it for 30, 35 years. And
one industry and one company
and
was
one
what
company.
The generation before me came in. Right?
Yep.
I was a job hopper as far as everyone was concerning. I've been in probably 20 industries in my life. So, yeah.
But I'm completely a millennial in that sense. I'm industry agnostic. I've worked finance, computer science, food, retail, and going into medical. So, but the one thing that I do know, like you said, 80% of the people wanted to manage. For me, I've always had a passion for, I love customer service. I love providing value.
You like relationships.
I love relationships. Yeah, to me that's really important. I've maintained all my relationships since the time, first grade teachers. I still have maintained relationships with. So for me, that's one of the big values that I get from everything. So that applies really well to managing and developing people too. So I can relate to what my dad's done in terms of finding people's strengths has been something I just. It's ingrained in my DNA.
So when you step into your role as an employee for someone or and doing the assessments, does it just go off in your brain? You automatically start thinking, okay, here's this manager and this is the way he wants detail. This one wants the strategic stuff. And you start just kind of assessing.
Yeah, know your audience with managers and with employees too. For me, the managing part of it I can speak to probably better. I've always tried to coach all my employees to, do what they do well,
right.
And don't worry about the other things quite as much. I'll worry about those things. I had a few employees that I've told, you're just in the wrong industry.
Right.
And I've been like, but I'm glad to give you references because you're great. But
just not here.
You're not.
You don't fit.
I ran a restaurant for a couple years and I had to tell a couple people that, this isn't necessarily what you're going to be good at for the rest of your life. So
that's an important thing because they get de-energized underperforming somewhere. Mm-hmm. And for someone to say, hey, you're great, you're just not a fit here, and let me help you get somewhere where it does fit.
Yeah.
Versus saying, oh, well, you're not doing this right, and you're fired, right?
Yeah.
And that's just kind of the mode you see so many people operate in. So when you're working with your peers as a manager and that motivation thing where – a lot of the management theory back in the day, before I had gray hair, was about money as a motivator or this incentive or that incentive. How are you assessing and dealing with millennials with their different priorities, their different outlooks, and that dynamic that's there?
I think feeling needed is probably the most important motivator for the millennial generation. Feeling like importance and a sense of respect and fitting in, too. Are more important than progress and growth and kind of taking over companies. I haven't encountered that a lot. In fact, I can only think of two people out of the probably 50 to 100 people that I've managed that have been like, I just want to go to the top. And I guess that was something that I always expected when I was in management training. You're always looking for those people that want to be shooting stars, and I don't think our generation is really shooting for that.
One, I've talked about it before on the show. I kind of think of it in the dynamic. There were mountain men right? When they've set in the country, they went out, they were the loners, but they cut the trails, they went out to find what was there. Then there were the explorers, the little teams that went out, like Lewis and Clark, and they went out to do things. Then along came the pioneers. Then came the settlers. And organizations need all of those. But the most people at an organization are the settlers. They sit there, they do the routine stuff day in and day out, which would kill my soul. I can't do the same thing two days in a row. And so knowing that and trying to get somebody that's a mountain man or an explorer to be a settler is just bad for them, and it's bad for the organization.
That's true in sales as well. What we've seen so crystal clear at some of the assessments, we've done so many with sales organizations, and every salesperson has a model in terms of what they're good at, what their style and what their strengths lead them to. And oftentimes organizations hire the hunter, the person that's got to go out there, get the new business, make it happen, and sign today. But once all of those customers have been signed up, somebody's got to take care of them. And there's account management, and there's all the nuances of how do we keep that flowing. And we're, even today, working with some organizations that recognize that there's a kind of a hunter in the organization that brought in the original customers. And now the model is much different. They've got a lot of business, a lot of things going on, but they need account management and account growth within that account.
They need the relationship people.
Yes, totally different kind of selling, totally different kind of maintenance of that particular account or accounts. And that's a challenge. When you hire people for today, what you recognize is that they're not going to always be the same required people 5 years down the road.
Well, the organization changes. Like, you'll see a founder CEO for a tech company or a spin out around here for the universities. And they have the skill set. They have the technology. They can lead the research. They can do those kind of things. But very few of them are going to have the sales mode to be able to grow it. They're not going to have the experience in the background or the time to learn those skills. There are a few that will, you know, will be a Steve Jobs or a Bill Gates or whatever that can be geeky and techie and management. But the reality is their biggest strength and the best part of what they did for the organization was that science or that technology, those skill sets. And at a point where you start to grow, a new CEO is going to have to come in to run that company as it's grown to that stage. That CEO is not going to stay there 30 years either, because once they get past the emerging market stage and get into the settle stage and the bigger companies that go public, it's a different CEO again.
Right. And what one of the things that we see this kind of animosity to corporations and how they grow and what they do and the emphasis on profits and what have you, the view of some people is that profits are bad, when in reality it's profits that generate the ability to change and to grow and to become much bigger and much better than you are originally.
When it's in the profits that you have the ability to give raises, to put in a new product, to do product development of more green products, or to give back to the community to support your local community radio station.
Exactly.
All of those kind of things. So profits are a result of a transactional value. I'm giving you money for something that you've given me that has a higher value than what the price was, because I'm not going to buy something that's only equal to the price. I want more value than that price. And then that means we grow beyond that transactional value. And when there's profit left over, I'm going to go hire David to do something. Or I'm going to go buy a pizza from Amante next door with that money. And that goes into the market and that grows and changes things.
The assumption that we can move from one thing to the other seamlessly used to be a thought that it just wasn't possible. And what we've seen today, and we do see it pretty routinely, is that people can grow and change dramatically. I think studies are done here at North Carolina and in most major universities today on brain training.
Right.
One of the things we spend a lot of time with companies to understand that they have the ability to change. And most people are reluctant to change. Most people put up all kinds of walls around them about change unless they're taught early on that that is what is a need for them and things that are of value to them.
Well, it's funny. I recently wrote a book. It's called The ABCs of Biblical Change Lessons from the Pentateuch. So we're in there and we're talking about change as a journey. You're going to change, just whether you're doing it willingly or the environment or other people are going to make changes that force you to change. Mm-hmm. And so we make choices. And every time we make a choice to be proactive in the change, to take responsibility for it, good things happen. Okay, we'll make mistakes and that kind of stuff, but to think we're just going to stay the way we are. I'm not the way I was 20 years ago. I'm not the way I was 20 months ago.
Right.
And so everything in our life changes us. We just don't always acknowledge that.
And go ahead, Dave.
David.
I just wanted to add one thing about the whole change process, and actually about the prophet thing too, is the idea of shared vision. And I think prophet without vision, it really can be a bad word, because it doesn't really have, there's no end to it. There's no reason for doing it. But when a company has a shared vision about why they want to be profitable, either to improve people's lives or to, like you said, have more public radio, those are the companies that in the end, first off, are more sustainable. They last longer. And
that profit, if a company takes advantage, and what we won't name, Government Motors. So if you look at and you make decisions about, am I going to put a product out there that could be dangerous because it's defective, or I'm going to have to do recalls or those kind of things. When you make decisions monetarily to not to the interest of your customers, the market's going to come back on that. They're going to stop buying your product. They're going to stop getting your stock. They're going to stop doing business with you. And so those profits go away. And so ultimately there is a market mechanism of, if I don't like doing business with you, I don't like what you stand for, I don't buy your product. If you sponsor a TV show that has content on it that I think is completely inappropriate and I call you and say, well, I'm not going to buy your products because of what you're putting on TV, then that starts coming in there. We can tweet about it now. We can Facebook. We can Instagram. We can do all of these different things to influence. So it is still a transactional thing. Profits don't stay where people are not happy.
Yeah, it's self-defeating when you run a business that way. And that's one thing that Mike coaches on pretty big time, actually, is about that vision and getting everyone on board with it, too, from top leaders to every worker. And when that vision is shared and you have a common goal, the change just follows that process.
Well, it's also your philosophy in running the business. When I started my business 12 years ago, I said I wasn't going to take clients that gave me flat forehead syndrome, which meant I was going to beat my head a brick wall and they weren't going to listen. And I wasn't going to take clients that I couldn't truly make a difference in. Mm-hmm. And so over the past 12 years, and I can remember the first one I turned down, which was, he was completely shocked. He's like, you're not going to take me as a client. I was like, no, because it's not going to be a good experience for anyone. And I can't help you if you won't listen. So let me get you to somebody you'll listen to. And then when it still hasn't worked, come back and I'll be happy to take you as a client. So it's that dynamic. It's knowing who you are, who you want to work with, how you want to work, and who you want to bring on your team that shares that.
That's absolutely correct. And the interesting part of that, the more you target companies that are specific companies that you want to work with, I do a lot of work with unemployed people. I have a coaching call that I do every Monday from 4 to 5 o'clock every week. And I act kind of as a sales manager for unemployed. Now, most people that are unemployed don't have an understanding that they basically need to be selling themselves 24/7. And it is a 24/7 job.
Yeah, when you're at church, when you're at the ballpark, when you're at school with your kids.
It's all of the things that are part of getting the process of sales laid out so that you have a vision. The only real goal that you have is to get in front of somebody that can hire you. And that requires multiple steps in between, a ton of marketing materials, the references, all of the documents for your resume, and all of the things
that you
have to do.
The relationships, the person, like you were saying, at church that comes up to you and says, what do you do? And that connection happens. It's that kind of thing. It's you're always in a sales mode.
Absolutely correct.
And sales is not a four-letter word. It has five letters.
Yes. And some people have a belief problem, even salespeople. One of the biggest things that we do in sales training, the first piece of the sales training process is teaching the belief system. Because if you don't believe in your product, and if you are the product, then there's a real problem and you don't believe in it. Because that makes for a long, long search.
Well, that authentic voice, when I believe in it, when I'm passionate about what the benefit is, what problem it can solve, it's worth the price,
right?
That comes across.
And it has to come across it throughout the process. I had a person on the call this past week that said they had been challenged by one of the higher level executives about why should I hire you? And I looked at that and said, well, wow, you had the close opportunity of the day. You had the opportunity to really close on how much value you could bring to that organization, how you've been practicing and preparing for a year to work for this organization. He was asking just a basic, simple question. Show me you're worth it. Show me that you're going to add value
to this company.
I'm going to
pay you
this
amount of money, yes. And what are you going to give me, and what's the long-term return?
Exactly. And that person got defensive instead of offensive. He got flustered by it because it was a tough question. But it's the question that everybody would ask. What are you going to do for me? All right. What are you going to do in my company to add value to my company? The more you understand that answer and the more prepared you are to give that answer when the question comes, if you're not hearing the question, you've got to plant the question.
Well, that question comes in different forms in everything we do. The politicians right now running for office.
Oh, gosh, yes.
They really need some coaching. Everyone wants to know how you're going to change my, how are you going to give me security? How are you going to deal with threats? How are you going to give me hope for the future? How are you going to grow the economy? When I'm selling a product, where I'm trying to get hired, whatever it is, that ultimately is what's in it for me? What are you going to do for me? If you can't articulate that, you might as well not have started the process.
That's exactly right. And when you look at the political scene and everybody recognizing they have to sell themselves, I remember very clearly one of the presidential candidates back in 2000 was using feel, felt, found. I mean, classic sales terminology that we use in sales training and what have you.
Who was that? No.
I could name names, but I'm not going to be political about this. But the reality is that it is a fact that people get trained in sales to be able to be a politician because you're selling your ideology or you're selling your benefits, you're selling the programs that you want to have enacted, the constant selling that's going on. And that's true of everybody. We're all in sales. All of us are selling
24/7. You're getting your kids to do something. You're getting your spouse to help you do something. Your neighbor, whoever it is. Everything you do is about relationships. And then it's an exchange. It's a persuasion.
Yes.
And it's confidence, too. I mean, you get paid to hear no's a lot.
Well,
nine no's.
You're
one.
Never going to get a yes without
nine
getting a thousand
no's. One yes can be a pretty profitable.
Yep. And that's the other part of it. It's a numbers game. I mean, nobody wants to hear that either, is how many times you have to present your case before you get the order, or how many times. They say statistically today that, interestingly enough, it takes about 12 touches to make a sale. And the average salesperson, 50% of them, give up after the first sales call.
Right.
So,
well, it's like inventors. Was it Alexander Graham Bell or Thomas Edison said,
well,
the reason I was so successful is because I didn't stop the thousandth time it failed. I went to the next one.
Right.
But, and that's kind of, I think politicians right now kind of give us a nice target to think about. When they're out there, they're selling, but they also have to realize not only are they selling their platform or their ideology, they're selling themselves individually.
Yes.
And if you can't answer questions, it's not in this state, but it was on the news last night. If you can't say what three books you think you want to read, if you don't have, like you're saying, okay, it's one thing to have brain freeze, but it's another thing not to be prepared for those questions that we're always going to get. A politician's going to get asked, what do you read? Where do you get your news? Those kind of things. As a candidate for a job and a job interview, you have to know what your value is.
Mm-hmm.
Whether they're going to buy it or not, you still have to have confidence in that value.
And it isn't that people haven't been tripped up by that in the past. The things that we know happen, we should be prepared for. That person that was looking for a job from a high-level executive should have been prepared for the question of, well, what have you been doing for the year that you've been out of work? Instead, he got defensive. It, again, it's the
I've been looking for the right company to put my skills to work for.
Sure. Yeah, we can all come up with answers, can't we?
Yeah.
We know that.
I've been preparing to work for you.
Yes.
Right.
Yeah. Right.
I was waiting for this opening.
Yep.
I've been investing my time in myself and bettering myself for a year.
Investing
in the process.
Dave has just gone through that process of interviewing multiple people, multiple layers, and that sort of thing. Maybe you could tell us a little some of the stories of some of the questions.
Yeah, because, I mean, it's very different now.
Yeah.
20 years ago when I went into Ford Motor Company, and I can remember being in grad school, they came and asked. I was interviewing all day. I interviewed with 15 people. And one of the things they did was a panel. There were five people in the room, and you walked in, and they hammered you with questions. I don't think that's the environment people are interviewing in most of the time today, and I don't think it would work if they were.
No, I think it's a softer interview process than that these days. But they can be pickier. I mean, we are in a tighter competitive.
You mean you can't look at your phone and text while you're in the interview?
Oh, no, that's all right, depending on the job. I mean, if the job's going to be a social media networking analyst, you sure look at your phone. But, yeah, knowing your audience is really important. But I think that really investing in the process and, like you said, believing yourself, really analyzing, but reflecting without becoming too focused on yourself and being narcissistic.
Wait,
about
like
it.
But you were talking about not being, you were agnostic as to industry.
Yeah.
Explain it, because when I did it, my conversation was, well, 80% of my skill set is what's transferable. I'm a finance person. I'm an accounting person. I'm a strategy person. Yeah, 20% is about your industry and your company, but I can learn that, and it's not going to take that long. How do you deal with that now? Because I know how it was received back in the day. How is it now? Are more people agnostic as to industry? Is everybody hopping from here to there to the other place?
Yeah, I know a lot of people that are pretty industry agnostic like myself. It might be, I think for me, it's a personal belief. I have friends that have been working for the same company for 12, 15 years, and I guess that's more of a classical business model. For me, the industry agnostic part of it is I guess I'm an analytical relationship builder. So I can analyze, you know, several different industries, and I actually like putting new ones under my belt. It's kind of fun for me.
Yeah, I think we're related.
Yeah, it's kind of like I have a Renaissance belief. You know, I like good food, good music, good wine, and
a challenge.
So that's where that comes from. But the thing that the commonality in all of it is relationship building and being able to analyze and look at a bigger picture and kind of planning for the future.
So what are you talking about in relationship building specifically?
In relationship building, it's, I guess the biggest part of it is understanding what their needs are and kind of looking at the customer's long-term goals and being able to show them, you know, these are some suggestions, these are some ways we can go with it, and having the confidence that you've already done this before, something similar, whether or not you know necessarily their exact field, it's not really very relevant. But building that relationship with them, listening to them, identifying, and then listening again after you've identified, because, you know, I think a lot of people create this concrete idea like, okay, I've got the answer. And, you know, it's ever evolving. Everything's changing. And the answer might be wrong, even if it was right yesterday. When I worked in the restaurant business, it was every day you had to analyze, you know, what are people doing today? What are people doing today?
Right.
And then, you know, moving forward after you've identified it, and you just keep listening. And that's what sales is. Sales is just good listening skills applied to the customer.
Well, and I think that industry you're talking about, restaurants, 85% of all restaurants that open fail. Because of the lack of analytical, because they don't know the customer, because they're not looking at their competition, what's changing today, who's done what, all of those kind of dynamics that you're talking about. But it is about relationships with your customers, with your vendors, with your community, all of those kind of things.
One of the things that Dave did and has said in this process that was really informative for me, as he was looking at how do I add value, what he was looking at in the restaurant industry was how has he had an experience. How does he make the experience of that couple or that person coming into that restaurant so positive that they are just blown away by it? And when they walk away, they are so happy to
have had the
experience.
They're telling everybody about it. Right?
Yes, yes. And that was a major piece of when we talked about when you have a job, you want to add value. What is the value that you're adding? He went the one step further and says, okay, what's the experience that I'm providing?
Right.
Right. And he had everybody in that restaurant understanding that if they were doing anything, whether they were the chef or whether they were somebody serving or somebody at the front reception area, they were all understanding this is an experience we're giving to this person.
Well, and it's a restaurant is about the food. The food can be as great as can be, but if the waiter really sucks,
yep,
you know,
or if it comes out cold,
or you watch them drop it and pick it back up and put it on your plate and bring it to the table. I mean, it doesn't. We come for the food, but we stay for the experience.
Yeah.
And that's true. We come for the product, we come for the service, but we stay for the relationship.
Absolutely. And that's how it is. Our food was very good, but the reason people came back is because they enjoyed the experience they had there. One of my favorite things to tell a guest that had a bad experience, it happens. You know, the food comes out cold, or we took too long because we were really busy at the moment. My favorite thing to tell guests was, it's going to be all right. And they would look at me for a second, and I'm like, because I'm going to make sure it is. And then they just, the confidence, you just let them know, I'm not letting you leave until we've come up with a...
Right. People don't mind mistakes.
Yeah.
They don't like the denial. They don't like the attitude. Mm-hmm. They don't like not being cared for after a mistake.
Exactly. And then the other part was knowing little details. This is the listening thing. Finding out their name, finding out any dish they liked. And this is kind of standard for the industry. But that detail relates to any business. Knowing, you know, the client's kids' names, knowing, you know, what kind of pets they have, what do they like to do on their Saturdays. Anytime you find information, I had them collect it, and we used OpenTable, which is the restaurant platform, and just put little notes. And then when they'd come back in, we'd open back up and it'd be like, oh, you love this dish. We don't have it anymore, but we have something like it. And people loved that. People loved knowing you cared.
As long as authentically used. One of the things that just drives me crazy is when I receive the birthday email or the birthday thing that I know is on automated responder, and there's an H on the end of my name, and my name is not Leah, it's Lee. Yes, it's L-E-A. But you can tell whether there's true, authentic follow-up on that. If I walk into a restaurant, knowing all my food allergies, if they remember that, they remember what I drink, or they remember, okay, we're going to have to adapt for this. Same thing if I go to get my car worked on. I need In-N-Out. I'm not spending my day and hours there doing it. Whatever it is, as long as it's authentic, use the tools, but don't do it as a robot. Okay, she needs to be In-N-Out on time, or it's this or whatever. That still has to be a relationship behind the information.
Absolutely. Yeah, without that, a robot could do it better. So hopefully we're better than robots still.
I've been served by robots, I think, before.
Well, the other part of it is that how do you upsell in an upscale sort of place and do it so gracefully and so appropriately that people want everything that you're selling?
Right.
And whether or not that's an auto part or whether or not it's in a restaurant or whether or not it's in a medical environment, if you've provided all of the pieces that the person needs to have that right experience, that's what your goal is.
And I think of home repair people when they come in to do, let's say they come in to do your fall service, check your furnace and this stuff, and then they start trying to sell you a HEPA filter and this thing and that thing and the other thing. I don't buy from anybody I don't trust. Mm-hmm. And I don't trust when the moment you come in and you're trying to sell me something. And that upsell mode can be the thing that causes you to lose your steady customer if it's not done well.
If it's not done well. And the whole idea of doing it appropriately and gracefully, that same issue of selling you the filters and what have you, you know, I would teach that it's probably a good idea to open up the thing, see a bunch of filters and say, well, this one doesn't need replacing, but this one does by the looks of things. Do you want me to do that one? All right. That way you're not trying to sell them the house. You're just basically taking care of the needs. And that becomes a positive experience as opposed to, they're just...
Well, yeah, because it's like they come twice a year to do the spring service in the fall, and they ask the same things. No.
Yeah.
And to use that automated thing, it says, okay, we've already offered it to the customer. Don't do it again.
Yeah.
Or those kind
of
things.
Or take the note out.
Take the note,
yeah. Change what the note
says.
Change
your script.
Yes. Change the script. Yeah, absolutely. We would change. We had a little block of probably 300 characters, so we'd have to fit.
Right.
It's kind of like two tweets, basically, to fit what we wanted to say about the customer in there. And the more pertinent stuff you want at the top, because you want to make sure that the host sees it. And I've also worked in automotive retail as well. So with the air filters, we actually, that was one thing that we would always try and push. It was part of the business model. We wanted to push it, but the company, I can say it's AutoZone. They did a great job in letting people know why they wanted to do it.
Right.
Just sharing the information to the customer and that, you know, you actually do need these things done, but without being pushy. Because if you're pushing,
content, information, marketing, informing the customer and letting them make the decision. And that's great. The other thing that gets me in sales is like if I call in and there's been a huge turnover. So I deal with accounting software firms, and I'll be in the middle of helping a client evaluate the software, and suddenly the entire sales team has either left, transferred, or, and you start the conversation over. Well, they've just lost $500,000 in sale because I'm not starting over, because the process isn't starting over, and I'm not going to tell you what's gone on in your company when we've been going through this process. But you've also failed one of the check marks. There is no continuity in anything if the first thing that doesn't succeed is the sales detail of what's been going on prior to the close is not handed off when you make a team change.
Yeah, sharing information.
Right. Yeah.
Yep. We installed CRM systems for 15 years, and we were partners with Microsoft and what have you for a number of years, because in the leadership and sales side of the business, one of the things we found very early was that it's either process or it's people. In the sales environment, when we first started out, it was crystal clear that processes were huge. They hadn't automated processes. Today, everybody's got CRM, right. Salesforce, or some cloud system or whatever. And we sold that business basically 5 years ago because it became an IT environment, right. rather than a leadership training and sales training, right. environment. But the early days of that, it was very clear that people resisted because they would asked to do things differently. Today, everybody's doing it. Everybody's seeing the advantage of doing, right. that. But nobody wants to be doing nothing but administration,
yes.
in sales. So there's a fine balance. And what you're seeing going on today is a lot of voice-activated everything so that it becomes easier and easier to input the information. But in leadership, it still comes down to leading by example, by leading in the right way, whether or not it's the company leadership or whether it's the sales leadership. It's the person that's got the right direction. They know their vision. They know what they're doing, and they consistently apply it. One of the parts of the victory lap that we talk about is knowing how to celebrate a win. And that's making sure you understand the stake in the ground. Where
you mean
you
it's
today?
Not congratulations and go out and get another $1 million in sales right now?
Right. It's all about looking at the little things, the steps along the way that cause the win that is the big win, and all of the activity that you have to do to have the big win is not exciting in times. As a matter of fact, it's downright boring and not so exciting. But recognizing that if I set the bar here and if I achieve it in this given day or this given time, then I can say I've got a success. And then celebrate that success with some little form of a victory lap or some exciting thing just to say, I just did it.
Tell us a little bit more about this victory lap program, because you've mentioned it a couple times, but give me a little bit more of the structure, what it is, what do you do during the program, and who do you do it with?
A victory lap to us is a one-year commitment to growth and change. And it has a vision, which is the V, and it's, and we initiate the change by assessing. We go through all the assessment and a battery of assessments. Then we focus on the change, and the change generally is that one-year effort. It's that time that you put into it. Nothing happens at the snap of a finger.
Change is a journey.
Nothing happens that way. Everybody recognizes that, but everybody wants it instantly. Right. So we look at that. We look at the team and the organization and the process that's a part of that. And then the R in victory is results. You have to get results. If you're doing all these things and you're not achieving results, you've got to go back to the beginning and start changing
it. Because either the process isn't working, you're not making the choices, you're not committed to the vision, it doesn't have value.
Right.
Results tell you bought in, you're doing the right things.
Right. And the why is basically you win. I mean, you basically have to have a win-win relationship in this entire process. If you're not winning for both the team and the organization and the individuals that are part of it, that's not a victory. The LAP is Leadership Achievement Process. We call it an achievement process. It's not a program. It's not a one-step and one-thing-fits-all sort of thing. Every victory lap that we put together is geared to the individual organization and their needs. And like I said, it starts with the initiation of a change of assessment, looking at all the things that need to happen. There's a whole book of things that we evaluate. You do the same thing in accounting. You look at the, okay, what do I audit here? Okay, there are a lot of pieces to that. What do I have to make sure the process is working?
Well, when you evaluate a company, you're looking at the financial, you're looking at the strategy, you're looking at the vision and the mission, you're looking at the team, and you're doing that within the individual and then the construct of putting that individual within the team's goals, the organization's goals, et cetera.
Exactly right. Yep. And we even celebrate that in a five-step process with the people that are going through job search. We use the exact same victory lap process with them to have them understand that it's a process. There are a number of things they have to do, and they have to do them consistently. All that activity that they have to do to get to the actual job offer is pretty significant.
Now, you said you do a call on Mondays, 4 to 5 on
four
that?
4 to 5.
Is that a call, an open call, or is it your clients? How does somebody get involved in that call if they're interested in that?
Just email me, mike@mcgrillgroup.com, and I'll send them an invitation. That's all that's required. It's sponsored
by mike@mcgrillgroup.com.
Right.
And it's 4 to 5 on Mondays for people who are in job transition.
Yes. Like,
all of them are unemployed, or they're getting ready to be unemployed? Or
generally, they are unemployed. Okay. Generally, if you're getting ready to be unemployed, there are other options or other things that you can be doing. But if you know that you've been served notice that you're going to be unemployed, then that's time to come see us.
Yeah, because there's a lot of that's getting ready to happen
and
in the
year. There's no cost for that. That's what we do.
It's your community give back.
Yeah, absolutely. Yep.
So your website is mcgrillgroup.com, and they can go in and see about Victory Lap and all the other sales, coaching, and process services that you're doing.
Yep.
If you could give our listeners three things that they could do today, we've got like a minute to talk about it. Mm-hmm. What three things would you tell them to do today?
I would suggest that they have to look at themselves in terms of their vision, understand what they want to change, and then affirm themselves that they will do the change. There's a new word now that is called using the third person. Instead of I will change, Mike will change. Mike will do this.
We used to say that was a sign of mental illness when you talked about yourself in the third person.
No, but it's been proven statistically, like the brain training, it's been proven statistically that using third person is more beneficial to you.
It takes you outside of your ego
to
do it. Very interesting. And before we wrap up the show today, I want to say thanks to both Mike and David for being with us on the show and for sharing the millennial perspective, David. That
thanks
was great.
Thanks for having us.
And I want to remind everyone that we are a community-supported radio, and we have an event coming up to celebrate our 10th anniversary and to raise funds for the station. So please join WCOM at the Hickory Tavern inside the Hampton Inn. That's at 370 East Main Street here in Carrboro on Thursday, November 6th. From 5 to 10 p.m. for our 10th year anniversary celebration and fundraiser event. On the way out, be sure to drop your receipt in the collection box because we're going to receive 10% of the proceeds from each of those receipts that hit that box. And that will help us fund WCOM's continued volunteer mission. We are 100% volunteers here. Our programmers, our board, everything happens because you guys in the community fund us. And so remember, November 6th, 5 to 10 p.m. at the Hickory Tavern in the Hampton Inn at 370 East Main Street. Be there to support the station. And until next time, stay focused on the important things.